Welcome to Rocket Talk, the Pro.com podcast. I'm Justin Lannon, your host, and I am joined tonight by Courtney Schaefer. She is the author of the Shattered Sigil trilogy, which began with the Whitefire Crossing and will end with the Labyrinth of Flame. She's a graduate of Caltech, works in electrical engineering, and is an avid rock climber and figure skater. Welcome, Courtney.
Hey, Justin. Thanks for having me.
Did I get all that right?
Yes, I believe you. You got most of that right.
Excellent. So hilariously, last episode I had my first guest from MIT, Monica Byrne, and now have you on as a Caltech grad. And I promise you, it's not like some kind of weird competition, but Caltech's better, right?
Oh yes, definitely. As all the MIT people rise up in arms, but you know why Caltech is better, and it has nothing to do with the academics. It's because I learned to rock climb and scuba dive and backpack and mountaineering there, as well as getting my degree.
Well, it's in California. I mean, that's kind of the advantage I think that it has. I mean, no offense to Massachusetts, but in terms of like year-round outdoor ability, Caltech's gonna get the win on that.
Yes, that is true.
And I believe it was the setting for the wonderful CBS drama Numbers. I believe the setting was Caltech, so that also has it going.
Well, the setting for Real Genius was Caltech. I mean, you know, you can't call yourself a nerd if you have not seen that movie. So I know that probably excludes half of the audience here.
depends on their age, perhaps. But yes, the Real Genius is a classic.
Yes, yes.
It's Val Kilmer, right?
Yes, it was Val Kilmer back when he was young and hot, a long time ago.
Val Kilmer's got some pretty good nerd cred over the years between that movie and then, I mean, Top Gun's not really a nerd movie, but, I mean, everybody loves Top Gun, so.
I used to love Top Gun, and then at Caltech during one finals week, the guy who was in the dorm room next to me decided that he was going to play that movie on infinite repeat for the entire finals week. So I can recite almost every line in the movie by heart, not by choice.
Wow.
Yeah, you know how Big Bang Theory, people kind of harsh on that show sometimes because they, I don't know, I guess misogynistic and whatever and all that, but I will say, you know what, their portrayal of some of the guys, oh my goodness, I lived right next door to them. This part of it is exactly right.
Yeah, so. I can imagine. A film did that to me as well, The Little Mermaid, which is nothing like Top Gun, but when I was in a young kid and my parents put me in daycare, where I was at daycare, I was actually pretty old to be in daycare, but, you know, my parents were very nervous people. And so the young kid that was in the daycare with me, his mom ran it, and she let him watch The Little Mermaid on loop. And so I saw The Little Mermaid somewhere, like, it was like 60 times within a 2-month period. And
I'm so sorry, Justin.
I can't. That movie comes on. My daughter, if she puts it on, like, I have to leave the room.
Yeah, do you run screaming? No!
Yeah, it's like that fruit that you ate as a kid, or like that candy you ate as a kid that you just puked up. Like, once you've done it, you can never go back, so.
Oh, wait, I just have to tell one more little movie story here. When I was 12 years old, my very first babysitting job, the next door neighbors, two little boys who were about, I think one was 3 or 4 and the other one was about 6, went over there and their parents handed me a movie and said, this movie is the one that they watch every night before bed. It was Predator, Arnold Schwarzenegger. And I had never seen an R-rated movie before because my parents were very, very, very strict. And I was like, this is the best babysitting job ever.
I also was not allowed to watch R-rated movies. So you have a pretty diverse set of hobbies. I mean, you climb, you skate, you engineer, you write, you raise kids. I mean, you got a lot going on, and it's kind of all over the place. Like, how did you get into all this different stuff? Were you into climbing and skating before Caltech, or is that something that you got into while you were out there?
No, you know, my parents were very indoor people, and I grew up in the D.C. area. I guess I did swim team and stuff, but I don't know. Somehow I always knew I wanted to do outdoor stuff. Actually, I guess my grandparents had a house up in the Appalachian Mountains, which, I mean, I guess compared to the mountains that I see in Colorado are, you know, kind of glorified hills where their part of the Appalachians was. But I just loved going up there as a kid, and they were the perfect grandparents, all permissive and let me run around, you know, with their dog through the hills and the forest. And I just loved that. And so I always knew I wanted to do that kind of stuff. But my parents are very not into that kind of stuff. So I had to wait till I went to college to kind of to pick that up. So thank goodness for Caltech there. I guess skating I also always wanted to do, but we lived too far from the rink for my mom to be willing to kind of take me there and everything, which, you know, oh boy, now that I'm a mom, I totally understand that restriction. But When I was 12 or so, I guess, I organized a group of my friends so that our moms could switch off who was taking us to the group lessons and stuff. And I guess once my mom saw how much I really loved doing it, all the other friends kind of fell by the wayside and stopped skating. But I kept on doing it. Of course, I was too old then, you know, at 12. I'll never forget a coach saying to me, "Oh, if only I had had you when you were 3, you know." But I still loved it. And by the time I came out to Colorado, I skated a little bit at Caltech, but not that much. But when I came out to Colorado, and I guess after I finished grad school here and got a job, they had just built a giant new rink near where I worked. And the USFSA, which is the figure skating authority in the U.S., had figured out finally that adults have money too, because they used to think, you know, adults can't learn it. You're too old, you know, you're too big, you're too heavy. But yeah, like I said, they figured out adults had money. And so they set up this whole competition structure going all the way up to adult nationals. And so I started taking lessons again and doing that. And I had a blast and worked my way up through the structure there. And I guess before my son was born, yeah, I competed at adult nationals a bunch of times. And I hope to get back to that now that he's a little bit older and I have some more time to train.
That's awesome. I with all of this other stuff going on, and as you said, being a mom, which as a father I know is very time consuming, how are you managing to fit in like writing into all of this? And I know you have a very intense day job as well.
Or something. I think my critique group jokes that I'm like the Energizer Bunny and don't sleep and all this. And ironically, I actually need more sleep than most people, which has made parenthood kind of hard. But I don't know. It's just one of those things where if you want something badly enough, you're going to find a way to do it. And so I write much slower than other writers, unfortunately. I mean, you know, you only have so much time, and unfortunately I'm not a fast writer ordinarily. So, you know, that's stressful when you're trying to meet a deadline, or, you know, you see other writers lapping you by like 3 books as you finish your next one. But, you know, thankfully for me, I try to treat writing seriously, but at the same time, for me, it is a hobby. So I don't have any dreams of writing full time, anything like that. I love writing and I love putting out the books, but so other people can read them, enjoy them too. But I'm not as career minded as, say, you know, Cameron Hurley, right? I always kind of watch her and go, wow, it's like an alien species, you know, compared to me in terms of how we look at our careers in writing and things like that. Cameron, of course, is also very driven and awesome and a go-getter and everything. But I guess I kind of channel that into climbing and mountaineering and skating and all my other hobbies. And she's there with writing and her day job and marketing. So it's really interesting. There's so many different people in the world and different ways of being a writer, which I think is really cool, actually, that it's one of these professions or even hobbies for someone like me that you don't have to be super driven at writing to have fun with it and publish and put out a professional product and everything. You can be having a great time as a sort of hobby thing. So I think it's cool. There's multiple paths.
So you say you're not a fast writer, but you're a total speed reader.
Yeah, I feel like it's karmic payback, actually, because I'm way over on the super fast end as a reader, and yet I am way over on the super slow end as a writer. So I feel that the universe is trying to balance the scales or something of that nature. But yeah, it certainly does help for, you know, reading books while I am trying to write and do all these other things, is that I can just, I don't know, when I finally get through a chapter or something, I can reward myself by taking an hour and reading somebody's fantasy novel and not having to break it up into little pieces. I hate that with a new book. I like to sit down and read it all in one chunk. I don't like to stop. So thank goodness I read fast, or else, I don't know, I would really be a slow writer if I kept getting sucked into somebody's book and never finishing it.
Yeah, I just want everybody to like hit the back button on your podcast player like 15 seconds and hear what Courtney just said, which is like, I'm going to take an hour break and read somebody's book. She doesn't mean read part of the book. Like, she means the whole book in an hour, which is pretty staggering, I think. And actually is the one thing that most writers complain about, is that they no longer have time to read. And, you know, you hear a lot of writers who only, you know, have the bandwidth to read maybe 10 or 15 books a year. When you can crank one out in an hour, that, I guess that restriction can go away, which is pretty awesome.
Yeah, well, and that's exaggerating a little bit. An hour would be for like a YA novel for me. Like, I remember I kept track for Mark Lawrence's sake of how long it took me to read his third one there, Emperor of Thorns, I think. And I think that was like 2.5 or 3 hours.
He is particularly envious, I think, of the speed at which you can read.
Well, that's all right. I'm horrendously envious of the, you know, have you heard him say that he never edits? For someone like me that has to rewrite every scene 10 times over before it's even halfway decent, I just, oh, I'm like, Mark, you know. But fair enough, right? We all have our strengths. So.
That's right. I have heard him say that. And I don't think you're the only one that has that reaction to his one drafts.
Yeah, mostly. I'm like, do you know how much more time I could spend in the mountains if I only had to write every scene once? It would be awesome, but oh well.
That's right. So your first book, The White Fire Crossing, which came out 4 years ago, something like that.
What is this now, 2015? 4 years ago, I guess.
Yeah, 4 years ago. Okay. And I know I should know that because I think I started my original blog, you know, like right around the time your first book came out, as it was one of the first books that I had read and reviewed. And
for the very first review, Justin.
That's right. I'd forgotten that. I was the first review of your book. That's right. But anyway, the first book, like, it had a ton of mountaineering and climbing in it. And I assume, as you were sort of writing your first novel that you were going to publish or that you'd hope to publish, was that just a classic, like, I'm going to write what I know and something that I love and hopefully that'll come through to the reader?
Yeah, it was the something that I love sort of thing, I think. When I set out to write White Fire, I really was just writing it completely for myself. It was the first book I ever wrote. I had no thought of getting it published. It was a bunch of work friends and I had decided to do NaNoWriMo, you know, where you try to write 50,000 words of a novel in November. And I started it and I was like, man, I'm having a blast. I mean, I had done some thinking about it beforehand because obviously I had been reading like a book a day for years and years and years, science fiction and fantasy. So I had a pretty good idea of what I personally wanted to read, what I wanted to read more of and what kind of things I might want to address. And I thought, for myself, I was like, well, I love climbing and mountaineering. Let me see if I can kind of combine this in a fantasy and magic sense, and that'll be extra fun. And so I did. And, you know, there was more climbing and mountaineering in the first draft because that was before I joined the critique group and had them, you know, critique it, and I got it up to publishable standards. So one of the great things about my critique group is that they are not climbers, so they can be like, Courtney, you are getting a little overboard with this, or, oh my god, I'm so bored by this scene because all he's doing is talking about how he ties his knots, you know, whatever. So that was very helpful, obviously, to have people reading it and critiquing it who know nothing about climbing and don't do any climbing. So certainly the published version, I mean, obviously there's still climbing in there, but I really tried to make it so that every scene wasn't just a climbing scene. It was either revealing something about the character or setting up something that I wanted to do later with the plot. You know, that each scene is not just a woohoo climbing, but has a purpose in the book.
It's so funny. You talk about, you know, your readers not really being climbers. I had to, when I read the book, I didn't know that Talus and Scree were like actual words.
You thought I made them up.
I was like, what are these crazy made up words about rocks? And so like I had to like look them up. They were probably the shortest words I've ever actually had to look up while reading. But no, I learned a ton about the whole thing as a result. So it was actually a lot of fun in that regard. You mentioned this like a NaNoWriMo novel. This first novel was a NaNoWriMo novel, as it's at least it, how it started. The book actually has a lot of lush world building. I mean, did you put that in? Was that something you had built before you started NaNoWriMoing, or is that something that you kind of put in after you got your 50,000 words and had to go back through and actually flesh it out?
No, I think most of it I had thought about beforehand. Some of it I probably thought about as I was going, you know. And of course, it's hard as a writer to look back and remember exactly what your first draft is like because first of all, there's what was in your head for the novel, which always kind of overwrites what you're reading on the page, which is why a lot of us are so bad at spotting things in our own stuff, right? Because you know what you were trying to say and what you're trying to get at. And you have to sometimes go through tricks like reading aloud, reading pages backwards and things like this to kind of get to what's actually on the page rather than in your head. It's kind of like that when I look back at that first draft. I'm like, what was that first draft like? Because now I know how the book really is, right? The published version. So it's hard to remember exactly what the differences were. But most of it, I think certainly all the stuff about Nineveh, I figured out before I started writing. I'm one of those people that I have to kind of know. I have to know the beginning and I have to know the end before I start writing the book, and maybe a couple signposts along the way. And then I kind of like to write my way between those signposts to kind of get to the end. And for me, then, you know, we talk about me being an engineer. For me, that kind of makes it a little bit like the same mental processes I use for designing algorithms, where you kind of, you're going to end up in this point and you're going to get from here. And how are you going to work the plot and the characters so that it feels organic to the reader, so that you're getting there where you wanted to go, you know, that kind of thing. I love that part of it.
every pantser, you know, people who write by the seat of their pants, every pantser just cringed when you compared writing to electrical engineering, but I'm all in on that.
Well, the funny thing is, I'm not a super outline writer. I remember for Tainted City, the second one, when I had to, I guess I missed my first deadline, I think, and I had to tell my editor, when am I really going to have this book done? And I had to sit down and outline, you know, every last scene, and then figure out how long it was going to take me to write it, you know, so I could give them a date that I was really going to make. And I found it took all the fun out of it for him, because, like, well, now I know what's going to happen in all those scenes. Why do I have to actually write it down? You know? So, like I said, I like guideposts, but I don't like to outline to the level of detail where I don't feel like I want to write the scene anymore, if that makes sense.
No, I mean, that's what a lot of people who have that writing process will say, that, right? That knowing what knowing everything that happens robs them of the sort of the joy of writing. And yet, then there are lots of other people that can't write without knowing every single thing ahead of time. So, you know, as you said, there's a multitude of experiences in the world of writing, from craft to career.
Yep. And that's cool about it, that we can all have different ways of doing it and still come out with great books. Hopefully.
So you had your first book, The Whitefire Crossing, and then the second one, The Tainted City. And now we've got the Labyrinth of Flame coming, which is going to be the third and final book in the series, and we'll talk more about that third book in just a minute. But in each of these books, you have two primary characters, Dev, right? Dev, D-E-V?
Yes.
Dev and Kieran.
Mm-hmm.
And they are both men, and we have there's a lot of talk in the community over the last, well, forever, about women writing in fantasy, and making sure that we have lots of characters in fantasy who are women and doing hero stuff. But then as a woman writing in fantasy, you chose to write these two points of view who are both men. And I find that interesting, especially because you've been one of the more outspoken people, I think, in the various conversations that we see pop up on Reddit and elsewhere about women in fantasy and how inspired you were by women writing fantasy as a kid. So I was just curious, having you talk a little bit about that choice to write these two male POVs.
Well, going to the idea of female characters in fantasy, you know, it's funny. I think in your first review of Whitefire, you said something that you mentioned this about me writing male characters and how you wished more men would write women. And I remember thinking at the time, huh? You know, because I guess maybe because I had read a lot of balance of women and male authors, like I hadn't really noticed at that point a dearth of female characters in fantasy. I mean, you know, everybody from Brandon Sanderson to Guy Gabriel Kay had written female point of view characters. And like I said, I had read a lot of female authors who had female point of view characters. Of course, now as I am more experienced in the publishing industry, and I've seen some of the, I don't know, I guess the disparity in targeting and marketing of male and female books, and how few people actually have read all those female authors that I enjoyed so much as you know, a young fantasy fan. You know, I can see where the issue comes from. But as far as my own choice to write male characters, again, I was writing the book just for me. And I will confess, I guess I don't know if I have to turn in my feminist card here for this, but I do have a slight preference for male protagonists. And I've said this before, and I guess it sounds terrible, but I've always thought it, because I'm a heterosexual, you know, straight woman, like having the male character, you know, you're on top of your general interest in the character, you can have like that little, you know, romantic attachment to them a little bit, which is kind of funny because I'm actually not much of a romance reader. I just, you know, it's not my favorite genre, but that is, has been true for me in reading, in books, that I tend to prefer male protagonists a little bit more. I mean, I there's lots of books that I like the female protagonists too. And I thought that was totally, I don't know, the way it was. I mean, my husband actually, prefers books with female protagonists. Like, his absolute favorite all-time series is, Raymond Feist and Jenny Wirtz's Mistress of Empire series, because mm-hmm. He absolutely loves, I guess it's Mara Akoma, I think is the female main character in that one. And when we watch TV shows, he always wants the ones with the female leads, you know, like Orphan Black and things like this. And I'm always like, bring on Arrow, you know. So I thought it was just, I don't know, I thought it was that way. Of course, then I in reading other people's posts about this and stuff, I realized, you know, there are a lot of women who enjoy identifying with the main character, of course, and it's nice to be able to see yourself in the heroic figures in the book, and so certainly I can totally understand that. And for me, like I said, I enjoy both, and I wouldn't rule out writing a novel with a female main character. It's just that when I wrote this first one, I happened to, you know, pick two guys because I thought that would be the most fun for me as a writer. And yeah, given that it's been, gosh, well, you know, I know the book's only been out for 4 years, Whitefire, but I've been writing Dev and Kieran for longer than that, because, you know, the book went through a rewrite before it was published. And so I, you know, I kind of say, well, if I was going to spend like 6 years of my life with two main characters, they better be some male eye candy there.
So basically you're telling me that you have a little crush on your protagonist.
Well, you know, I mean, neither of them would be the sort of person I want to hook up with in real life, but I find both of them interesting in different ways. And yeah, you know, I find each of them a little bit hot, so.
I appreciate the honesty. The other interesting thing about these two characters is how you chose to write them. You've written Dev in the first person and Kieran in the third person, which is not something that you see attempted very often. I won't say it's as rare as, like, second person, but seeing them juxtaposed in the same book is pretty rare. What got you into that? What made you want to do that?
Well, the simplistic answer is, again, I was writing the book for myself, and I remember I actually sat down and wrote that first scene that it opens with Dev in first and then in third, and I was like, yeah, definitely first, you know, for this guy. And then I wrote the first scene with Kieran in first, and I didn't like it, and I ended up liking third better for him. And so, again, I was writing for myself. I was like, well, I like it this way, so I'm just going to keep going. And but I think the more interesting question lies in why that was true for me. And I think it's because for first person, I've always preferred books where the first person character is kind of snarky and sarcastic and, you know, streetwise and whatever. Examples being like Cat and Joan Vinge's Cat's Paw and Scion, those books. Or even more recently, things like, I don't know if you say Droth in Doug Hulick's Among Thieves. Mm-hmm. Characters like that I really enjoy in first person. Whereas for me, more introspective, moody, angsty characters, as Kieran is, for me, I feel it tends to get bogged down a little bit in first person, because that kind of character is always kind of going over their, you know, every single action, thinking about how it plays out and all this, and angsting over everything. And for me, I prefer the emotional distance of third person a little bit, because I feel it keeps the pace of the story moving better. So again, that's my personal preference, and that's how it played out that way. And I am, of course, fully aware that it drives a minority of readers up the wall to have this the way it is. Interestingly, no agent or editor ever complained about it when the book was on submission or anything like that. Actually, I take it back. I think one editor on submission said, sort of like you did, can you tell me exactly why she chose to write the characters that way? But yeah, nobody was like, oh, I'm not buying this because of that. I do understand that some readers find it jarring to switch between the two. And it's just one of those things where, you know, as an author, you make choices, and if those choices are what you wanted from the story, then if you feel strongly enough that that's what you wanted from the story, you just have to accept that sometimes there's going to be people who that's not going to work for them. And, you know, that's true of every choice that you make in the book, some more than others. But as long as you're happy with it as a writer, I think it's okay.
Well, I, for one, just want to thank you for saving us from excessive brooding in the first person from Kieran. That's the first thing. The second thing is, I actually found it incredibly jarring the first time it happened. You know, because I was like, wait a minute, what did I miss? You know, what's going on here? And then after the first time it happened, it was fine after that. But yeah, no, it was definitely, it's definitely unique. And I think that's actually, something to your credit, that it's something that you don't see very often, that even if the book's also doing a lot of other fun and interesting things, but it's one of the things that I think will sets it apart from a lot of other books out there that don't take any chances with POV. And I think there's so much cool stuff that you can do with POV. And so I liked it.
Well, certainly fun as a writer, because you to get really deep into a character's head in first versus in third, it actually kind of requires a different set of authorial skills. So I really enjoyed as a writer getting to practice both of those at the same time in a given book. So like I said, I don't regret it, although I do realize that it has, I suppose, limited the audience for the books slightly. But the majority of readers seem to be okay with it, even if, like you, they found it a little bit like, what, at first. It seems like people can get used to it, so.
Your third book, The Labyrinth of Flame, is now on the Kickstarters, and you've put it out there. It's already funded, which is fantastic. I'm sure you're very excited about this.
Yes, I was thrilled.
211 backers. And a rather large number who have put in a rather sizable chunk to get all three of the books, which I think is, I'm sure you're very excited about that as well. How's the experience been?
Oh, it's been really good so far. I mean, everybody's right when they say Kickstarter is a lot of work. It is. So definitely be aware of that if you're someone who is considering it. But I think it's been a really good choice for me for this book, because it's letting me put it out just the way that I wanted it, you know, with Dave Palumbo doing the art again, just like the first two. And I can have it look just the same, and I can, just have it the way I want and produce a book that will give readers a match set of the trilogy. And I'm really excited about that. And it'll be even more cool if I guess this next stretch goal, I don't know if we'll make it because it is, you know, a stretch, but if I get to commission an artist to do interior art for the book, I think that'll be really fun because there's a couple scenes in there that I think would be really cool to illustrate. I mean, not me personally because I'm terrible at art, but somebody professional who is good. So,
And I think recording, you need about what, like $2,500 more to hit that stretch goal?
Yeah, I haven't, gosh, I've been so busy today, I haven't even looked at it, but yeah, I think it's at, like 6,700 now, and it has to get to 9,000, to meet that stretch goal, so we'll see. You know, it's not even halfway, I think, through the Kickstarter period, which is funny because it sounds like, oh, only 29 days for a Kickstarter, but then it goes on and you're like, oh my goodness, I feel like this has been going on for weeks, you know? I mean, part of that is, you know, you're constantly talking about yourself and the book and, trying to, I guess, let people know about the Kickstarter. And I've been doing a post on my blog every day with a mountain picture and a book recommendation, and I'm not used to posting so much because I haven't in a long time. I was kind of doing like once a month posts before, so this is a big step up for me. And so, yeah, I'm like, wow, are there really that many days left?
Yeah, right. We're not all Cameron Hurley. Again, we're not all Cameron Hurley with the ability to do, 45 blog posts in 7 days.
Oh, I know. I was thinking about that. I have this blog post to finish for somebody. And I was thinking, my God, Cameron would have been writing like, how many of these? But, of course, as Cameron herself will point out, anything that you practice a lot, you become much better at. And she, of course, had been blogging for quite a long time and has gotten very, very good at it. So I'm sure that helps a little bit, but still, I don't think I could ever do the mega blog tour. My brain would just leak out of my ears. And also I just wouldn't have the time to generate all those blog posts. But anyway, like I said, this Kickstarter has been fun. I'm really glad. I'm willing to try anything once. And one of the most awesome things about it actually has been how awesome everybody has been about helping me. The people who have done Kickstarters before, people have been just so generous with their time and advice. People like Brad Bullier, who, did a Kickstarter for his third in his original series out of Nightshade. And Michael Sullivan's wife, Robin Sullivan, who ran his Kickstarter for Hollow World. She had lunch with me at World Fantasy and gave me all this advice, and she even kind of looked over my Kickstarter page before I put it live and gave some great feedback and stuff. And yeah, just people have just been so supportive and helpful. And it's one of the things about publishing, one of the great things about it is the people that you meet in it, because there are just so many really nice, wonderful people in this industry, even crazy as it is. So that part's been really great too.
Well, you've invoked the name without me bringing it up, and You mentioned Brad Bolyar's, he was originally published by Nightshade. You were also originally published by Nightshade. Your first two books, The Whitefire Crossing and The Tainted City, were published by Nightshade, and still are, I should say, published by Nightshade.
That's right.
But you've decided to self-publish this third book. Why make the decision to kickstart this one instead of Dang Traditional? Was that a decision that you made, or was it kind of a decision that you made with Nightshade, or was this an example of you just not really wanting to work with Nightshade anymore?
It was solely my and my agent's decision. There were some business reasons went into it, but the biggest one for me was just speaking as someone who's not so much a career writer as a hobby writer, I always try to maximize my joy and minimize my stress. And when I looked at what I thought it would be like going Kickstarter versus going with Nightshade, I decided that I thought the least stressful option would be Kickstarter. And, you know, I don't want to say, I mean, the new Nightshade, a lot of those guys are doing great, great things for their authors, and they are trying hard to kind of get back on the wagon and make a great imprint, and I wish them nothing but the best. But, you know, it was a little, not the new Nightshade, but the old Nightshade, it was pretty traumatizing going through that bankruptcy thing, so, or almost bankruptcy thing, I guess I should say. I remember when it went down, we went to Australia to visit my husband's parents and family. He's in Australia. And that whole month, that was when we were all having to make those decisions about signing over the contracts and stuff. I was on, my agent called me in Australia every day for the entire month. It was, you know, my husband was kind of like, oh, you've got to be kidding me. You know, are we going to have a real vacation here, or are you going to be stressing over this the whole time? And anyway, I didn't want any more publisher problems to interfere with getting the book out. And in the end, we didn't even offer it to the new Nightshade. So I just decided I was going to go the Kickstarter route, and that was that. And like I said, I wish them the best, and I think that they've got a chance to really make the new owners have a chance to make the imprint a great thing again. So I hope that's true, because Nightshade, the great thing about it, aside from putting out beautiful books, which they did, they took a lot of chances on books that the bigger houses, you know, weren't willing to take risks on. And I think that's a really valuable place in the publishing industry, to have a publisher that can still get books into bookstores and, you know, kind of be on the play on the same distribution playing field as the big boys, but is willing to take risks on edgier or otherwise fiction that the bigger houses didn't think that they could market successfully. So.
Yeah, sadly, and I think lost in all of the kvetching that went on during the Nightshade debacle, as I call it, and it has been this, that has actually been a great loss to the community in terms of, with Nightshade now sort of still, I think still, and on life support in a lot of ways. I only say that not necessarily financially, but just because we haven't seen them really reestablish themselves fully within the landscape. I think they're still finding their legs, but and Pyre has had their struggles, and we don't really have right now a real healthy mid-sized press, with probably the exception of Angry Robot, although Angry Robot has also recently undergone some transitions as well. So it's definitely a hard environment to be that sort of mid publisher, but without that mid publisher, you know, who is taking the chances? And I think for the community's sake, we really need one or two or all, you know, three of these mid-sized publishers to survive, because where else are we going to groom some of these edgier authors? And if you look, Cameron Hurley and Brad Bolyar and all these other people have gone on to sign deals with bigger publishers, and they've got amazing stuff coming out, and maybe they never get there without Nightshade.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I say about Nightshade when it comes down to it. Despite all the craziness over the bankruptcy and everything, I mean, I will be forever grateful that they took the chance on Whitefire that they did, because Whitefire had gone to acquisition at several of the larger houses and been shot down by marketing. So I, you know, they were willing to step up and take the chance, and I am forever grateful to them for that, because it's just been so wonderful to have the book go out there and to have people enjoy the story. And every email that I get that is from a reader that's just like, oh, you know, I really enjoyed your book, and I loved your characters and everything. I mean, I had so much fun all those years reading all of those novels, and getting so much joy out of those stories, that the best thing I can think of is giving that joy back to someone else. And, you know, people say, oh, well, you know, you could have self-published or whatever, you know, if no house had taken a chance on it. But, you know, as a new to publishing author, I wasn't confident enough to do that. I'm not saying, I don't know what would have happened if nobody had wanted to buy Whitefire, but, you know, I think it would have gone much differently without Nightshade taking that chance. And so I'm always grateful that they did.
It is strange that a writer who is more of a hobby writer like yourself, and I'm sure you're learning this with Kickstarter, I feel like the part-time writer is much better off with a traditional publisher because self-publishing takes so much time.
Amen to that.
Yeah,
certainly for my next series, you know, people, I guess I did a Reddit AMA recently and people were all like, oh, are you going to keep self-publishing? Are you going to kickstart again? You know, and I'm like, not if I can help it.
Yeah.
Because some people really enjoy having the full control over everything in the book. And some people really enjoy playing project manager over all the production aspects and stuff. And that is so not me. I want a publisher to do all that, and I am perfectly happy to take a significant cut in my profit off the book if somebody else will do all the tasks that I don't really want to have to do myself. I mean, the one exception to that, I will say, it was really fun working with Dave Palumbo for the art for this third book, The Labyrinth of Flame, because before with Nightshade, I remember with Whitefire, we hadn't even signed the contract yet. I think they were still arguing with my agent about details, and one day I get this email from my editor, it's like, here's your cover, hope you like it. And I remember being like, whoa, I was still worried that, I don't know, that somehow the Nightshade would change their mind, or, you know, when you're a brand new author with a brand new book deal, I don't know, you have, until you actually sign and see the contract or something, you have this nightmare that is all just going to vanish in smoke. But seeing the cover, I just remember being like, oh, this is really, actually really going to be a book. people are going to read. But anyway, I mean, I love Dave's art for that first cover, but the point is that I had very little, you know, say in it or input. And that was the same way for Tainted City. One day you get emails like, here it is, you know. But this time I got to work with Dave saying, you know, I had always given him pieces from the book, I guess. I should correct that. For the first one, he had read the entire manuscript, the submitted manuscript, I think. For the second one, he asked me for some stuff and I gave him some scenes. And so that was kind of similar for the third. I gave him some scenes and a synopsis and everything. But then, you know, he went off and did his thing, and then he sent me back three roughs of three different concepts he had, and I got to choose, and we got to kind of, and I, you know, I think his first version of the art that is on the cover now had Deb in the background with like a lantern or something, and I was like, oh, can we have Deb, you know, at least have a rope, be doing something climby in the background, and so he changed that, and you know what I mean? It's not very often that a traditionally published author gets to play kind of art director in that way, so that was actually really fun, and Dave is a great guy to work with, so that has been the highlight of the self-publishing experience so far.
Awesome. All right, so The Labyrinth of Flame is the book that you are kickstarting right now. The series, if you were going to describe the arc of the series to somebody, how would you describe it?
Well, I think the overall arc of the series, for me anyway, is about Dev and Kieran each finding ways to find safety and freedom for themselves and decide how far they're willing to go to get that safety and freedom, you know, for themselves and for the people that they love. Of course, you know, I guess there's a little bit of escalating stakes in each book. The first two are more concerned with the city of Nineveh, and in the third one, there's more the risk that the antagonist character, Ruslan, who they've kind of had against them in the previous two novels as well, that he may kind of take out an entire country or whatever. But for me, the book has always been about these two characters' kind of personal struggle and personal journey. And so that still happens in the third, although, you know, it's always difficult to talk about a third book without spoiling anything, but, you know, they not only have to take on Ruslan, they have to take on these, shall we say, creatures out of legend that have taken an unhealthy interest in them, and there are some new characters and another city on the brink of revolution and all this kind of stuff going on. So it's not to say that it's a very internal book in that way. So yeah, this is the big finale. There'll be fireworks, both magical and emotional, as I like to say. But one of the most fun things for me about this third book actually is the partnership between Dev and Kieran. You know, they form this reluctant partnership in the first book. And then in the second book, they end up spending quite a bit of time apart and kind of having that partnership shaken for various reasons. And in the third book, not only do they kind of rebuild their relationship and their partnership again, but they've kind of been outclassed and on the run and faced with these enemies that, way overpower them for so long that finally in the third book, they get to kick a little ass together. And that was actually really fun to write. Not just the kicking ass part, but the way they do it, you know, using each other's strengths in a way to kind of go against their enemies. And I really had fun with that part of it. So I am looking forward to seeing how readers enjoy that as well.
And one other thing I'll point out about the book before we wrap up here, because I remember writing something about a weapon in relation to the series. I think I once said that, you know, made a comment about Dev's sword or something, and you tweeted at me like, actually, there are no swords in these books. And there's actually very little weapons in the book, too. I mean, a lot of it's not to say there's not violence. I mean, there definitely is violence, but it's different.
Well, my thinking there was, this is not meant to be medieval fantasy. In my head, this is kind of like the 1800s, 1700s, 1800s-ish sort of thing. It's just that because they had magic, they have developed these ways of using magic that are more analogous to, you know, how, I guess, technology would have done in our society. And so that's why you don't see, I don't know, people using like flintlocks and stuff like that very much. Because, you know, they have these charms that can act as defensive barriers. I think there's a couple comments made in there, you know, yeah, I mean, some of these other countries that don't have as many mages on hand, they use, you know, gunpowder and this and that and the other thing. But people from Nineveh, which is a city, not a country, but still, they scoff at that, you know, like our magic can totally, all the charms and stuff that they use, kind of replace a lot of that. So again, it doesn't make much sense for people to be whacking at each other with swords or anything when these charms can do a lot more deadly and powerful things than that. So that's kind of why I didn't end up with that many traditional weapons. I think, you know, some people use some crossbows and maybe there's some slings and stuff like this, you know, I mean, for people who don't have access to the charms. But yeah, really magic is the weapon in these books. So
hopefully that gives listeners here a little bit of an idea of what these books are all about. I have been a big fan for a long time, and I've read each of these books as they've come out, and I haven't backed the Kickstarter yet, but only because I tried to, and I got really annoyed that I couldn't do it with my Amazon account anymore, and I didn't have my credit card.
Oh, that's right, because they switched from Amazon payments, I believe,
right,
Kickstarter
right.
did.
So I actually had to have my credit card handy, so now I just didn't have it at the time. It was, my wallet was not near me, so I will be backing it very soon, and I would encourage others to as well. And if you were so inclined, getting all three books, if you haven't read the first two, would be well worth your while. So
yeah, and I made a special arrangement to be able to offer ebooks of the whole series to everybody, even though Nightshade still owns the rights to the first two. So especially if you're an international person, this is your chance, because Nightshade does not currently sell ebooks of the first two novels outside the U.S. and Canada. And of course, I know there are other ways that people can get them, but let's just say that if if you would like perfectly legal, wonderful copies of the ebooks where all the profit goes to me, then this is an excellent chance. And also, since Kickstarter isn't using Amazon payments anymore, none of the profit goes to Amazon. Ha ha. So
there you go. I mean, it's good for everybody, particularly you. That's a good thing.
And I just want to say also thank you to everybody who has backed the Kickstarter and who does back the Kickstarter. I mean, because this is a situation where really this book would not be able to get out there in this form if not for you. So I am just, you have my undying gratitude, every one of you.
Well, thanks so much for being on tonight, Courtney. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Justin.
All right, this has been Rocket Talk.